tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Guys, this is going to be part two of The International Jew by Henry Ford. We have finished the introduction, and we are moving on to part one, or chapter one, I suppose. You have to remember, too, it's my understanding that when these were published, it didn't all come out as one book fully written. They published each little section or chapter or segment as its own article in the Dearborn Independent, and there were four volumes. Volume 1 was titled The International Jew, and 4 volumes in total, and it was more of a compilation of the articles. So, Germany's reaction against the Jew, I don't know if this was during the 20s, in the 30s, after 33, I don't know yet, I haven't read it. But this is Germany's reaction against the Jew. Humanity has become wise enough to discuss those forms of physical sickness over which it formerly drew the veil of shame and secrecy, but political hygiene is not so far advanced. The main source of the sickness of the German national body is charged to be the influence of the Jews, and although this was apparent to acute minds years ago, it is now said to have gone so far as to be apparent to the least observing. The eruption has broken out on the surface of the body politic, and no further concealment of this fact is possible. It is the belief of all classes of the German people that the collapse which has come since the armistice and the revolution from which they are being prevented a recovery are the result of Jewish intrigue and purpose. They declare it with assurance. They offer a mass of facts to confirm it. They believe that history will provide the fullest proof. The Jew in Germany is regarded as only a guest of the people. He has offended by trying to turn himself into the host. There are no stronger contrasts in the world than the pure Germanic and the pure Semitic races. Therefore, there has been no harmony between the two in Germany. The German has regarded the Jew strictly as a guest, while the Jew, indignant at not being given the privileges of the nation family, has cherished animosity against his host. In other countries, the Jew is permitted to mix more readily with the people. He can amass his control unchallenged. But in Germany, the case was different. Therefore, the Jew hated the German people. Therefore, the countries of the world which were most dominated by the Jews showed the greatest hatred of Germany during the recent regrettable war. Oh, so this must be, well, this could be about World War I. We'll see. Jewish hands were in almost exclusive control of the engines of publicity by which public opinion concerning the German people was molded. The sole winners of the war were the Jews. Oh, that's absolutely true, Henry. But assertion is not enough. Proof is wanted. Therefore, consider the evidence. What occurred immediately upon the change from the old regime to the new? The cabinet, composed of 6 men, which substituted the Minister of State, was dominated by the Jews, Haas and Landsberg. Haas had control of foreign affairs. He was assistant to the Jew Kautsky, a Czech who in 1918 was not even a German citizen. Also associated with Haas were the Jews Cohn and Hertzfeld. The Jew Schiffer was financial minister of state, assisted by the Jew Bernstein. The secretary of the interior was the Jew Prose, and with the Jew Dr. Freund for his assistant. The Jew Fritz Max Cohen, who was correspondent of the Frankfurter Zeitung in Copenhagen, was made government publicity agent. The Kingdom of Prussia duplicated this condition of affairs. The Jew Hirsch and Rosenfeld dominated the cabinet, with Rosenfeld controlling the Department of Justice and Hirsch in the Department of the Interior. The Jew Simon was in charge of the Treasury Department. The Prussian Department of Justice was wholly manned and operated by Jews. The director of education was the Jew Fertran, with the assistance of the Jew Arndt. The director of the colonial office was the Jew Meyer Gerhard. The Jew Kastenberg was the director of the Department of Art. The War Food Supply Department was directed by the Jew Worm, while in the State Food Department were the Jews Professor Dr. Hirsch and Gerhemret Stotthagen. The Soldiers and Workmen's Committee was directed by the Jew Cohen, with the Jews Stern, Hertz, Lowenberg, Frankel, Israelowitz, Lebenheim, Seligson, Katzenstein, Laufenberg, Hyman, Schlesinger, Mertz, and Weil having control of various activities of that committee. So the Kingdom of Prussia, along with Germany post-World War I, just loaded with Jews. The Jew Ernst is the chief of police in Berlin. In the same office at Frankfurt is the Jew Seinsheimer. In Munich, the Jew Steiner. In Essen, the Jew Levy. It will be remembered that the Jew Eisner was president of Bavaria, his financial minister being the Jew Jaffe. Bavaria's trade, commerce, and industry were in control of the half-Jew Brentano. The Jews Lipsinski and Schwartz were active in the government of Saxony, the Jews Thalheimer and Hyman in Württemberg, and the Jew Fulda in Hessen. Two delegates sent to the peace conference were Jews, and a third was notoriously the tool of Jewish purposes. I'm guessing this was the Versailles Peace Treaty. In addition, Jews swarmed through the German delegation as experts and advisors. Max Warburg, Dr. von Strauss, Merton, Oscar Oppenheimer, Dr. Jaffe, Deutsch, Brentano, Bernstein, Strzok, Rathenau, Wassermann, and Mendelssohn Bartholdy. As to the part which Jews from other countries had in the peace conference, German observers declare that any candid student may discover by reading the accounts of impartial non-Jewish recorders of that event. Only the non-Jewish historians seem to have been struck by the fact. The multitude of Jewish writers apparently judged it wise to conceal it. Jewish influence in German affairs came strongly to the front during the war. It came with all the directness and attack of a flying wedge, as if previously prepared. The Jews of Germany were not German patriots during the war, and although this will not appear a crime in the eyes of the nations who were opposed to Germany, it may throw some light on the Jew's assertions of patriotic loyalty to the land where he lives. Thoughtful Germans hold that it is impossible for a Jew to be a patriot, for reasons which will presently be given. The point to be considered is the general claim that the persons already named would not have obtained the positions in which they were found had it not been for the revolution, and the revolution would not have had come had they not brought it. It is true that there were unsatisfactory conditions in Germany, but they could and would have been adjusted by the people themselves. The conditions which destroyed the people's morale and were made impossible of reform were in control of the Jews. The principal Jewish influences which are charged with bringing about the downfall of German order may be named under three heads. First, the spirit of Bolshevism, which masqueraded under the name of German socialism. Number two, Jewish ownership and control of the press. And number three, Jewish control of the food supply and the industrial machinery of the country. There was a fourth, quote, higher up, but these worked upon the German people directly. as it is possible that German conclusions upon this matter may be received doubtfully by the people whose public opinion has been shaped by Jewish influence, and may help to quote George Peter Wilson of the London Globe, who wrote in early April 1919, quote, "Bolshevism is the dispossession of the Christian nations of the world to such an extent that no capital will remain in the hands of the Christians, that all Jews may jointly hold the world in their hands and reign wherever they choose." End quote. As early as the second year of the war, German Jews were preaching that Germany's defeat was necessary to the rise of the proletariat, at which time Strobel declared, quote, "I openly admit that a full victory of the country would not be in the interest of the Social Democrats," end quote. Everywhere it was preached that quote, "the exaltation of the proletariat after a won victory is an impossibility," end quote. These instances, out of many, are cited not to reopen the military question, but to show how the so-called German Jew forgot loyalty to the country in which he lived and joined the outside Jews in accomplishing the collapse of Germany, and not merely, as we shall see, to rid Germany of militarism, which every thoughtful German desired, but to throw the country into such confusion as to permit them to seize control. Now, I want to depart from the text here for a second. This is absolutely true and confirmed elsewhere by other authors that I've read. Bolshevism thrived on international war and war-torn conditions. They don't want a military victory in a country that they seek to overthrow. They want a military defeat to destroy the morale of the population and to create impoverished conditions, war-torn conditions, to where people will accept Bolshevism after 3 days of not having enough food to eat. Do you understand what they're doing there? They intentionally made Germany lose. Hitler wrote about this in Mein Kampf. The unions were controlled by the Bolshevik Jews, and they went on strike in the arms and munitions factories just as Germany was winning and about to end the war. And all of a sudden, there was a production strike orchestrated by the Jews, by the Kikes, by the Bolsheviks, so that Germany could be more susceptible to Bolshevism. Bolshevism had already taken root in Russia, in formerly Tsarist Russia, in 1917. Lenin and his Jewish cohorts took control, and they had their eyes set on Germany. And Germany was a big chunk of power that they wanted to grab, and they sabotaged Germany in World War One, and nearly took it over had it not been for Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist Workers' Party of Deutschland. Anyways, continuing on with the text here. "The press of Germany echoed this plan of the Jewish spokesman, at first faintly and then boldly. The Berliner Tagblatt and the Municher Neuester Nachrichten," sorry, my German's terrible, "were during the whole war official and semi-official organs of the government. They were owned and controlled by Jews, as was the Frankfurter Zeitung and a host of smaller papers that were their spiritual descendants. These papers, it is charged, were really German editions of the Jew-controlled press of the Allied countries, and their purpose was the same. One of the great pieces of research that ought to be undertaken for the purpose of showing the world how its thought is manufactured for it every day, and for what ulterior purposes, is this union of the Jewish press, which passes for the public press throughout the world." That's absolutely true as well. "The food and supplies of the people quickly passed into Jewish hands as soon as the war emergency came, and then began a period of dishonesty which destroyed the confidence of the bravest. Like all other patriotic people, the German people knew that war meant sacrifice and suffering, and like other people, they were willing to share the common lot. But they found themselves preyed upon by a class of Jews who had prepared everything to make profit out of the common distress. Immediately, Jews appeared in banks, war companies, distribution societies, and the ministries of supplies, wherever the life of the people could be speculated in or taxed. Articles that were plentiful disappeared, only to reappear again at high prices. The war companies were exclusively Jewish, and although the government attempted to regulate the outgo of food in the interests of the will of the people, it became notorious that those with money could get all of anything they wanted, regardless of the food cards. The Jews simply trebled the price of the goods they let go without the cards, and so kept a stream of the nation's gold flowing into their private treasuries. None of the government's estimates of the food stocks could be depended upon because of the hidden hoards on which these speculators drew. This began to disturb the morale of the people, and complaints were made and prosecutions started. But as soon as the cases came up, it was discovered that the prosecutor appointed to charge and the commissioner appointed to judge were also Jews, and so the cases usually wore themselves out without results. When, however, a German merchant was caught, great noise was made about it, and the penalty placed upon him was equal to what all the others should have had. Go to the length and breadth of Germany today, say the reports, study the temper of the people, and you will discover that the abuse of power by the Jews has burned across Germany's memory like a hot iron. While these influences were undermining the mass of the people, higher influences of Jewish origin were operating upon the same government. The advisors of the Bethmann-Hallweg government were the great ship magnate Balin, a Jew, Theodor Wolff of the Berliner Tagblatt and a member of the pan-Jewish press, von Gwinner, director of the German bank who is connected by marriage with the great Jew bankers, the Spires, and Rathenau, the leader of Jewish industrial financial activities. These men were at the source of things and were bending the government as the other influences were bending the people. The rich German Jew could buy the recognition he desired by acquiring financial power over those interests, which were most directly affected by the ruling class of Germany. But how was the poor Jew to gain the recognition he desired? For all Jews are actuated by the same desire. It is in them. They feel the spur to mastery. Having explored the conquest of the higher circles by Jewish money power, there is yet to explore the conquest of the body of the nation by Jews who had no money except what they could seize in the disorder which they caused. The analysis that is given follows here. The Jew is not an anarchist. He's not a destructionist. All this is true, notwithstanding he is the world's Bolshevist and preeminently Germany's revolutionist. His anarchy is not ingrained. It's a device which he uses for a purpose. The rich Jew is not an anarchist, because he can achieve what he desires by more subtle methods. The poor Jew has no other recourse. But rich and poor go jointly for a long stretch. The bond of sympathy between them never breaks, for if the anarchy is successful, then the poor Jew shall take his place with the rich Jew, and if the anarchy is not successful, it has nevertheless served to break up new fields in which the rich Jew may operate. In Germany, it was possible for the poor Jew to thrust himself up through the wall of Germanism above him only by breaking it up. In Russia, the same was true. The social system had encrusted around the Jew, keeping him in a position where, as the nations knew by experience, he would be less harmful. This reminds me of Behind Communism. We learned that the Jews were bound in the ghetto in the steppes of Russia until one of them killed the Tsar and weaseled his way into power and allowed the Jews out and gave them full citizenship rights, right? As nature insists the harmful foreign element in the flesh, building a wall around it, so nations have found it expedient to do with the Jew. In modern times, however, the Jew has found a means of knocking down the walls and throwing the whole national house into confusion, and in the darkness and the riot that follows, sees the place he has long coveted. When Russia broke, who first came to light? Kerensky, who is a Jew, but his plans were not radical enough. And then came Trotsky, another Jew. Trotsky found the system too strong for him to break in America. He broke through the weak spot in Russia and would extend that weakness around the world. Every commissar in Russia today is a Jew. Publicists are accustomed to speak of Russia as if it were in disorder. It may be that Russia is, but the Jewish government of Russia is not. From a mass of underlings, the Jews of Russia came up a perfect phalanx, a flying wedge through the superinduced disorder, as if every man's place had been previously prepared for him. That also is the way it was in Germany. The German ceiling had to be broken, as it were, before the poor Jews could realize their ambition. When the break was made, they swarmed through and settled in places of control above the nation. This may explain why Jews the world over supply the energy of disruptive movements. It is understood that the young Jews of the United States are propagandists of an ideal that would practically abolish the United States. The attack is aimed, of course, against quote-unquote capitalism, which means the present government of the world by the Gentile. The true capitalists of the world are Jews, who are capitalists for capital's sake. It's hard to believe that they would wish to destroy capital. They wish to obtain sole control of it, and their wish has long been in fair way to fulfillment. Boy, that's dead on the money. You got that right, Henry. In Germany, therefore, as in Russia, distinction is made between the methods of the rich and of the poor Jews, because one method affects the government and the other the morale of the people, but both converge on the same objective. It is not only desire to escape oppression that actuates the lower classes of Jews, but desire to gain control, for the spirit of mastery pulses strong within them. German convictions on this question have reached the place where they may be expressed thus. Revolution is the expression of the Jews' will to power. Parties such as the Socialists, the Democrats, and Free Thinkers are but tools for the Jewish plan to power. The so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, quote-unquote, is really and practically the dictatorship of the Jews. So suddenly have German eyes been opened, so stormfully wrathful has been the reaction, that the world has gone out through German Judaism to retire to the second trench. There has been a sudden and concerted abandonment of office wherever the office made direct contact with the public. There has, however, been no abandonment of power. What will happen in Germany is not now known. Some regrettable things have already happened, but the Germans will doubtless prove themselves equal to the situation by devising methods of control at once unobjectionable and effective. But as to Russia, it is hardly doubtful any longer what will happen there. When Russia turns, a shudder will run through the earth. How Gentile Germany and Russia look at the entire question may be summarized as follows. Judaism is the most closely organized power on earth, even more than the British Empire. It forms a state whose citizens are unconditionally loyal wherever they may be, whether rich or poor. The name which is given in Germany to this state, which circulates among all the states, is All Juden. The means of power of the state of All Juden are capital and journalism. or money and propaganda. All Yudan is the only state that exercises world government. All the other states can and may exercise national government only. The principal culture of all Yudan is journalistic. The technical, scientific, literary performances of the modern Jew are throughout journalistic performances. They are due to the marvelous talent of the Jews for receptivity of others' ideas. Capital and journalism are joined in the press to create a political and spiritual medium of Jewish power. The government of the state of all Yudan is wonderfully organized. Paris was its first seat, but now has been moved to third place. Before the war, London was its first, and New York its second capital. It remains to be seen whether New York will now supplant London. The drift is toward America. As all Yudan is not in a position to have a standing army and navy, other states supply these for it. Its fleet is the British fleet, which guards from hindrance the progress of all Jewish world economy, or that part of it which depends on the sea. In return, all Yudan assures Britain an undisturbed political and territorial world rule. All Yudan has added Palestine to British control. Wherever there was an all Yudan land force, whatever national uniform it may wear, it worked with the British Navy. All Yudan is willing to entrust the government of various strips of the world to the nationalistic governments. It only asks to control the governments. Judaism is passionately in favor of perpetuating nationalistic divisions for the Gentile world. For themselves, Jews never become assimilated with any nation. They are a separate people, always were, and always will be. All Yudan's only quarrel with any nation occurs when that nation makes it impossible for all Yudan to control that nation's industrial and financial profits. It can make war, it can make peace. It can command anarchy in stubborn cases, it can restore order. It holds the sinews of world power in its hand, and it apportions them among the nations in such ways as will best support all Yudan's plan. Controlling the world's source of news, all Yudan can always prepare the minds of the people for its next move. The greatest exposure yet to be made is the way that the news is manufactured and the way in which the mind of the whole nation or of whole nations, rather, is molded for a purpose. There you go, Henry Ford talking about fake news 100 years ago, almost. When the powerful Jew is at last traced and his hand revealed, then comes the ready cry of persecution, and it echoes through the world press. The real causes of the persecution, which is the oppression of the people by the financial practices of the Jews, are of course never given publicity. Of course. All Yudan has its vice governments in London and New York. Having wreaked its revenge on Germany, it will now go forth to conquer other nations. Britain already has. Russia it is struggling for, but the chances are against it. The United States, with its good-natured tolerance of all races, offers a promising field. The scene of operations changes, but the Jew is the same throughout the centuries. Published by the Dearborn Independent, issue of May 29th, 1920. Okay, so this is just after World War I officially ended, quote-unquote, 1919. And, wow, this is incredible. This is incredible stuff, what we just went over here. Him writing this, it's no wonder this man was an absolute genius and visionary. He knew this, he saw this coming. He knew that the Jews were just using the British Empire, Soviet Russia, and that America would be their next place that they moved to after Germany, of course. and that they just use these Gentile goy governments to rule over them, and it's all about controlling the governments via finance. And he was dead on the money. This is incredible. He wrote this in 1920. Germany's reaction against the Jew. He's talking about the German reaction to the Jews backstabbing Germany in World War I, and little did he know that in the matter of only a decade, really, would Adolf Hitler rise to the scene with the National Socialist Workers' Party and eventually take power as chancellor in 1933. This is incredible. This is incredible that he saw this and knew this in 1920. It would be like seeing in 1916, 1917, even 1915. Of course, there was an attempt to take over Russia by the Jews in 1905. That failed. But seeing as it happened, or shortly after the power changes happened, that it's a big Jewish power grab. This is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. So that's the end of Germany's reaction against the Jew. We're at about 30 minutes. I will move on to the second part here. Give me one moment. Okay, here we go. This will be part three, or rather the second section. I'm including the introduction, which is unlisted in the table of contents as an actual section, but you get the picture. We're going to move on to the total third part for us, and this next part is Jewish history in the United States, and it starts out with an excerpt from Werner Sombart's book, The Jews in Modern Capital, pages 38 and 43. Quote, "At first sight, it would seem as if the economic system of North America was the very one that developed independently of the Jews. Nevertheless, I uphold my assertion that the United States, perhaps more than any other land, are filled to the brim with the Jewish spirit. This is recognized in many quarters, above all, in those best capable of forming a judgment on the subject. In the face of this fact, is there not some justification for the opinion that the United States owe their very existence to the Jews? And if this be so, how much more can it be asserted that Jewish influence made the United States just what they are, that is, American? For what we call Americanism is nothing else, if we may say so, than the Jewish spirit distilled." Interesting. I would disagree, but he's of course talking about economic free enterprise and capital and capitalism. Okay, moving on. Jewish history in the United States. The story of the Jews in America begins with Christopher Columbus. On August 2, 1492, more than 300,000 Jews were expelled from Spain, with which event Spain's prestige began its long decline, and on August 3rd, the next day, Christopher Columbus set sail for the West, taking a large group of Jews with him. They were not, however, refugees, for the prophetic navigator's plans had aroused the sympathy of influential Jews for a long period previously. Columbus himself tells us that he had consorted much with Jews. The first letter he wrote detailing his discoveries was to a Jew. Indeed, the eventful voyage itself, which added to men's knowledge and wealth, quote, "the other half of the earth," was made possible by Jews. The pleasant story that it was Queen Isabella's jewels which financed the voyage has disappeared under cool research. There were three Muranos, or secret Jews, who wielded great influence at the Spanish court. Luis de Santiguel, who was an important merchant of Valencia and who was farmer of the royal taxes. His relative, Gabriel Sanchez, who was the royal treasurer, and their friend, the royal chamberlain Juan Cabrero. These worked unceasingly on Queen Isabella's imagination, picturing to her the depletion of the royal treasury and the likelihood of Columbus discovering the fabulous gold of the Indies, until the queen was ready to offer her jewels in pawn for the funds. But Santiago craved permission to advance the money himself, which he did. 17,000 ducats in all, or about $20,000, perhaps equal to $160,000 today. That would be 1920 standards. It is probable that the loan exceeded the expedition's cost. Associated with Columbus in the voyage were at least five Jews: Luis de Torres, interpreter; Marco, the surgeon; Bernal, the physician; Alonso de la Cal, de la Calle, and Gabriel Sanchez. The astronomical instruments and maps which the navigators used were of Jewish origin. Luis de Torres was the first man ashore, the first to discover the use of tobacco. He settled in Cuba and may be said to be the father of Jewish control of the tobacco business as it exists today. Columbus's old patrons, Luis de Santiago and Gabriel Sanchez, received many privileges for the part they played in the work, but Columbus himself became the victim of a conspiracy fostered by Bernal, the ship's doctor, and suffered injustice and imprisonment as his reward. From that beginning, Jews looked more and more to America as a fruitful field, and immigration set in strongly towards South America, principally Brazil. But because of military participation in a disagreement between the Brazilians and the Dutch, the Jews of Brazil found it necessary to emigrate, which they did in the direction of the Dutch colony of what is now New York. Peter Stuyvesant, the Dutch governor, did not entirely approve of their settling among his people and ordered them to leave, but the Jews had evidently taken the precaution to assure their being received even if not welcomed, because upon revoking the order of Stuyvesant, the directors gave, as one of the reasons for the Jews being received, quote, "the large amount of capital which they have invested in the shares of the company," end quote. Nevertheless, they were forbidden to enter public service and to open retail shops, which had the effect of driving them into foreign trade, in which they were soon exercising all but a monopoly because of their European connections. This is only one of the thousand illustrations which can be given of the resourcefulness of the Jew. Forbid him in one direction, he'll excel in another. When he's forbidden to deal in new clothes, he sold old clothes. That was the beginning of the organized traffic in second-hand clothing. When he was forbidden to deal in merchandise, he dealt in waste. The Jew is the originator of the waste product business of the world. He was the originator of the salvage system. He found wealth in the debris of civilization. He taught people how to use old rags, how to clean old feathers, how to use gallnuts and rabbit skins. He has always had a taste for the furrier trade, which he now controls, and to him is due the multitude of common skins which now pass under various alluring trade names as furs of high origin. The idea of renovation gained commercial value through the Jew. In the, quote, ragmen, who blow tin horns through our cities and save the old iron, old bottles, old paper, and old fabrics, we have the commercial descendants of these earlier Jews who turned adversity into success by converting the rubbish of the earth into material value. Unwittingly, old Peter Stuyvesant compelled the Jew to make New York the principal port of America, and through a majority of New York Jews had fled. And though a majority of New York Jews had fled to Philadelphia at the time of the American Revolution, most of them returned to New York at the earliest opportunity, instinct seeming to make them aware that in New York was to be their principal paradise of gain. And so it has proved. New York is the greatest center of Jewish population in the world, It's the gateway where the bulk of American imports and exports are taxed, and where practically all the business done in America pays tribute to the masters of money. Well, yeah, it's the Empire State. The very land of the city is practically the holdings of the Jews. A list of the property owners of the metropolis reveals only at rare intervals, a Gentile name. No wonder that Jewish writers, viewing this unprecedented prosperity, this unchecked growth and wealth and power, exclaim enthusiastically that the United States is the promised land foretold by the prophets, and New York, the New Jerusalem. Some have even gone further and described the peaks of the Rockies as the mountains of Zion, and with reason, too, if the mining and coastal wealth of the Jews is considered. The new waterways proposal, which will make an ocean port of practically every great city on the Great Lakes and take from New York the prestige she has maintained by being the gateway toward which the principal railroads narrowed, is being strongly protested at this time. And the strongest motive in opposing this most obvious betterment is that so much wealth counted in New York is not wealth at all, but fictitious values depending solely on New York remaining New York. When anything comes which will make New York merely a city on the coast and not the city where the great taxers sit to levy their tribute, much Jewish wealth will decrease. It was fabulous before the war. What it is now, the statisticians will hardly undertake to say. In 50 years, the increase in the Jewish population of the United States has been from 50,000 to more than 3.3 million. In the British Isles, there are only 300,000. In Palestine, only 100,000. It's fortunate for the Jew himself that in Great Britain his numbers are not greater, for the large and evident control he exercises in great matters would sometimes make it inconvenient for the poorer Jew if he were abroad in England in large numbers. An unusually well-informed Briton says that anti-Semitism is always ready to break out in England upon sufficient cause, but it cannot break out against the inaccessible rich Jews who control in politics and international finance. It is probably true that the commonest real cause of anti-Semitism is the action of the international Jew, who is often unknown and always secure, but the innocent victim of it is the poor Jew. Anti-Semitism, however, will be considered in the next article. The figures representing Jewish population in Great Britain and the United States indicate that the colossal power wielded by international Jewish financiers is neither consequent nor dependent upon their number. The arresting fact about the Jew is his worldwide unchallenged power, coupled with comparative numerical inferiority. There are only about 14 million Jews in the world. They are about as numerous as the Koreans. This comparison of their numbers with the Koreans will illustrate still more vividly the phenomenon of their power. In the time of George Washington, there were about 4,000 Jews in the country, most of them well-to-do traders. For the most part, they favored the American side. Haim Salomon helped the colonies out with the loan of his entire fortune at a critical moment. But they never assimilated. They did not take up the usual employments nor farming. They never seemed to care for the worry of manufacturing things, but only for the selling of them after they were made. It is only of recent years that the Jew has shown any capacity for manufacturing, and most of what he now engages in has grown up as an adjunct to his merchandising plans. By manufacturing, he saves a profit. The result has not been a decrease in cost to the public, but an increase. It is characteristic of Jewish business methods that economies are for the sake of the business, not for the sake of the public. The commodities in which there have been the most inexcusable and exorbitant increases in prices to the public, and the lines of business which have been most quickly frightened into lower prices without any explanatory change in the general situation, have been those lines in which Jews exercise the widest amount of control. Business, to the Jewish mind, is money. What the successful Jew may do with the money after he gets it is another matter, but in the getting of it, he never permits, quote-unquote, idealistic slush to interfere with the dollar. His dollar of profit is never clipped by any of the voluntary reforms by which a few men are trying to ameliorate the condition of the workers. This is not by any means due to the hardness of the Jewish heart, but to the hardness of the Jewish view of business. Business is to it a matter of goods and money, not of people. If you're in distress and suffering, the Jewish heart would have sympathy for you. But if your house were involved in the matter, you and your house would be two separate entities. The Jew would naturally find it difficult, in his theory of business, to humanize the house. He would deal with it after a manner which other people would call hard. But he would not feel the charge to be just. He would say that it was only, quote-unquote, business. It is probably this way that the Jewish sweatshops of New York may be explained. When the susceptible people of the nation commiserated the poor Jews of New York, of the New York sweatshops, they, for the most part, did not know that the inventors and operators of the sweatshop method were themselves Jews. Indeed, while it is the boast of our own country that no race or color or creed is persecuted here, but liberty is ensured to all, still, it is a fact, which every special investigator has noted, that the only heartless treatment ever accorded to the Jew in the U.S. came from his own people, his overseers and masters. And yet, there is no evidence that either the sweater or the sweated ever thought of it as inhumanity or as heartless. It was business. The sweated lived in the hope of having a room full of people sewing for him or her someday. Their endlessly vital interest in business and their unflagging ambition to get further up the ladder and become masters in their own sweatshop enabled them to work without the slightest sense of oppression or injustice, which, after all, is the sorest thing about poverty. The Jews never regard work as a calamity, but neither do they regard subordinate positions as permanently theirs. Thus, they spend their energies in getting up and out rather than in lamenting the inconveniences of the place where they are and trying to improve it. You know, I've thought it before, and you know what? There is a lot to learn from the Jews, and this is one positive aspect that they are always wanting more, wanting better. Meanwhile, too many times it seems to me, our people are simply content to be where they are and not better themselves. There's my one positive thing I'll say about these people. All this is individually excellent, but socially harmful. The result is that, until recently, the lower ranges of employment were wholly unsupervised, and the higher circles never felt the necessity of devising industrial reforms and benefits. The record of the great Jews in charity is very noble. Their record in industrial reforms is nil. With commendable sympathy toward their own people, they'll donate a part of their profits to rectify some of the human need resulting from the method by which they made their profits. But as for reforming the method by which they get their profits in order that the resulting need might be diminished or prevented, apparently it has never occurred to them. At least, while there are many charitable names among the wealthier Jews, there are no names that stand for an actual practical humanizing of industry, its methods, and its returns. This, of course, is unfortunate, but it is intelligible. More than that, it's explanatory of many things for which the Jew is blamed by those who do not understand his nature. The Jew will go part way in sharing the results of his prosperity. He has not gone any length, save upon outer compulsion, in sharing the processes or sharing wealth in the making. And while the social effect is the same as if this were done out of cruel insensibility and inhumanity, still it must be said that mostly it's done not out of such feelings, but out of the Jews' ingrained conception of the game of business. Some proposals of industrial reform appear as crazy to him as would a proposal to credit one's baseball batter's hit to his opponent's score, just as a matter of humanity. The American Jew does not assimilate. This is stated not to blame him, but merely as a fact. The Jew can merge with the people of America if he desired, but he doesn't. If there is any prejudice existing against him in America, aside from the sense of inquiry which his colossal success engenders, it's because of his aloofness. The Jew is not objectionable in his person, creed, or race. His spiritual ideals are shared by the world, but still he does not assimilate. He cultivates, by his exclusiveness, the feeling that he does not, quote, belong. This is his privilege, and from one point of view it may indicate excellent judgment, but he must not make it one of the grounds of his complaint against Gentiles in general, as he has a tendency to do. It is better that he should make it clear to Gentiles once and for all where true Jews stand in the matter. As when a young Jew said, quote, "There is all the difference in the world between an American Jew and a Jewish American. A Jewish American is a mere amateur Gentile, doomed to be a parasite forever." End quote. The ghetto is not an American product, but the Jews' own importation. They have separated themselves into a distinct community. Speaking of this matter, the Jewish Encyclopedia says, quote, "The social organization of the Jews resident in America has differed little from that in other countries. In the main, and without any compulsion, Jews prefer to live in close proximity to one another, a peculiarity which still prevails." End quote. To make a list of the lines of business controlled by the Jews of the United States would be to touch most of the vital industries of the country, those which are really vital and those which cultivated habit has made it to seem vital. The theatrical business, of course, as everyone knows, is exclusively Jewish. Play producing, booking, theater operation are all in the hands of the Jews. This perhaps accounts for the fact that in almost every production today can be detected propaganda, sometimes glaringly commercial advertisement, which does not originate with playwrights, but with producers. Here's a list of the industries they control. The motion picture industry, which that's a whole subject I'd like to get into another time on another program. The sugar industry, the tobacco industry, 50% or more of the meatpacking industry, upward of 60% of the shoemaking industry, men's and women's ready-made clothing, most of the musical purveying done in the country, jewelry, grain, more recently cotton, the Colorado smelting industry, magazines, news distribution, the liquor business, and the loan business, of course. No surprise there. These, only to name the industries with national and international sweep, are in control of the Jews of the United States, either alone or in association with Jews overseas. The American people would be vastly surprised if they could see a lineup of some of the, quote, American businessmen who hold up our commercial prestige overseas. They are mostly Jews. They have a keen sense of the value of the American name, and when in a foreign port, you stroll up to the office which bears the sign, quote, American Importing Company, or American Commercial Company, or other similarly non-commercial names, hoping to find a countryman, an American, you usually find a Jew whose sojourn in America appears to have been all too brief. This may throw a sidelight on the regard in which American business methods, quote-unquote, are held in some parts of the world. When 30 or 40 different races of people can carry on business under the name American and do it legally too, it's not surprising that Americans do not recognize some of the descriptions of American methods which appear in the foreign press. The Germans long ago complained that the rest of the world was judging them by the German-speaking Jewish commercial traveler. Instances of Jewish prosperity in the United States are commonplace, but prosperity, the just reward of foresight and application, is not to be confounded with control. The prosperity of the Jews can be had by anyone who is willing to pay the price for which the Jews pay for it. A very, very high price, as a rule, all things considered. But it would be impossible for any Gentile coalition under similar circumstances to attain the control which the Jews have won, for the reason that there is lacking in the Gentile a certain quality of working togetherness, a certain conspiracy of objective, and the adhesiveness of intense raciality which characterizes the Jew. It is nothing to a Gentile that another man is a Gentile. It is next to everything to a Jew that the man at his door is another Jew. So, if instances of Jewish prosperity were needed, the case of the Temple Emmanuel in New York might be cited, which in 1846 could scarcely raise $1,500 for its budget, but in 1868, following the Civil War, raised over $700,000 from the rental of 231 pews. And the rise of the Jewish clothing monopoly as one of the results of the same Civil War might be cited as an instance of prosperity plus national and international control. Indeed, it might be said that the Jew has succeeded in everything he has attempted in the United States except farming. Well, that's true. The explanation usually made in Jewish publications is that ordinary farming is far too simple to engage the Jew's intellect, and therefore he is not enough interested in it to succeed. But that in dairy and cattle farming, where the brain is more necessary, he has made a success. Numerous attempts have been made in various parts of the U.S. to start Jewish farming colonies, but their story is a series of failures. Some have blamed the failures on the Jew's lack of knowledge of scientific farming, others on his distaste for manual labor, others on the lack of the speculative element in agriculture. In any case, he stands higher in the non-productive employments than in this basically productive one. Some students of the question state that the Jew never was a man of the land, but always a traitor, for which assertion one of the proofs offered is the Jews' selection of Palestine as their country, that strip of land which formed a gateway between East and West and over which the overland traffic of the world passed. That is the end of part 3. This was published on June 5th, 1920. I want to thank you for being with me. Hope you enjoy. Time. God bless. Bye-bye.